Overweg evil dream. Leave my baby alone. Go away, evil dream, go away now. She wakes up crying every night.
Hey, did you ever find that guy's head yet?
Oh, it'll turn up.
Been thinking for a little while about how video, then disc, then now raw data has been affecting the world of being a movie buff. Back when I was younger, being a movie buff meant going to cinemas and waiting for film festivals and waiting for a good film that you wanted to see to come on television or to be shown at some retrospective on the big screen. And so the ability to become a movie buff really depended on your ability to get to certain places at certain times to watch certain things. That's no longer the case. Everything's on our desktop, literally. We can access all sorts of films, not instantly, but with a reasonable lag of a couple of hours, we can pretty much acquire a copy of pretty much any film we like. And I'm just wondering where that's leading. If anyone's got any ideas on this, please do let me know. But I've just got this impression that we're heading towards something as far as the world of being a movie buff concerned. There are any number of podcasts and blogs and Twitter streams and all sorts of things. And so there are a lot of people out there who are really hardcore film buffs, and of course everyone in the audience listening to me pretty much is. But where's it going? What are we going to do? What's the convergent element between blogs and podcasts and that ability to watch pretty much any movie pretty much any time you wanted to? I'm sure there are going to be times when people put out, and they're already doing it to a certain extent, but fan-made commentary tracks are going to become a much bigger thing, and I think that people are going to start putting commentary tracks on films that don't otherwise have them, if they haven't already. I mean, there are some podcasts doing it, and I'm being a bit vague here, so I do apologise for that. But I kind of like to find out where things are heading towards, and there is a sense of momentum with a world of people who enjoy film, and all sorts of film, whether it's just a meathead action flick or it's the deepest of darkest of French existentialist cinema. I mean, where are we going with it? I'd kind of like to know, but I'm also looking forward to the journey of getting there. I really think that the democratization of being a film buff, where you don't have to just be somebody who's gone through film studies and who can spend time in darkened cinemas with your sunglasses on watching Eric Romare films and things like that. I really don't know where it's going, but I want to find out. Anyway, this is Terry Frost, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 52.
Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at cinema between 1895 and 1990. We look at cult films, science fiction, action movies, foreign language cinema, and anything else that may be interesting. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The podcast website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast may contain adult words and content, so if your kids listen to it, you may have to explain a lot of uncomfortable things to them.
And of course, we now also have our voicemail line, which is 206-666-4886. If you'd like to leave a voicemail, 206-666-4886. Hi people, how's it going? Things here are going great. I know you guys have got summer in the Northern Hemisphere, though. You do seem to have a bit of a problem cleaning up some messes in the Gulf of Mexico, but we'll leave that aside. Things are going well here. The new job's going fantastic. I'm actually working rather than training in the new job, and I'm still enjoying it a lot. Who's to say what the future brings, but at the moment I'm really grooving on what I'm doing. And caught a few films as well, so I really should talk about what I've been watching. Did see Iron Man 2. We got it about 2 weeks before the United States did, which is a nice change given the fact that for the previous century or so, America always got movies before Australia did. But we got Iron Man 2, and I enjoyed it. A lot of people said that it sagged in the middle and there was a problem with it, with the centre of the film, but I didn't really find it that way. I found the character stuff as interesting as the action stuff, if not more so, because I'm really getting into character as my main interest in film and other things these days, so I went there. And Mickey Rourke was incredible, Robert Downey Jr. was good. Scarlett Johansson, does her face ever move except her lips when she speaks? I'm really having a problem with her as an actress. She seems to have that same mask-like demeanor that she had back when she did Ghost World in the early 2000s. Not one of my favorite actresses. Gwyneth, nail Gwyneth in an instant. She'd definitely be on my hit list if I was single. And, of course, a millionaire and able to screw Gwyneth Paltrow. But anyway, enjoyed Iron Man 2. Big Marvel movie geek. We did just finish watching Planet 51 on DVD, which is kind of ordinary and not too impressive. Still grooving on the Blu-ray thing. We've picked up a few Blu-rays. Sal picked up Nightmare Before Christmas on Blu-ray. We did pick up the really bad Will Ferrell movie Land of the Lost fairly cheaply on Blu-ray. And we've just now got the Guy Ritchie, Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes to watch. Nothing else apart from really grooving on Fringe, the TV series, which unfortunately the last episode of the second season is next week. But I'm really getting into character in film and TV. And I think the father-son dynamic in Fringe is pretty impressive. And John Noble should get a shitload of Emmys. Really impressive actor. Incredibly nuanced for television. Television acting can be pretty broad at times, and people can be seen as going through the motions a little bit, but when somebody who's done stage acting for about 30 years comes in and adapts, and not everybody who does stage acting can adapt to television, but when someone like John Noble comes in and adapts to television but brings that gravitas and that skill and that artistry to the screen, it can be something special, and I think in this case it is. If you haven't watched the second series of Fringe, maybe what you want to do is either get the DVD box set when it comes out of season 2, and season 1 of course, you've got to watch this whole story arc, but catch it or grab a torrent, whatever your taste may be, and just watch the thing through. It's probably the best science fiction I've seen in a number of years on television. And that includes Battlestar Galactica, which I wasn't particularly impressed with. But anyway, on to this week and this podcast. I'm doing the films of Larry Cohen. If you don't know who Larry Cohen is, by the end of the podcast, you will. He made films from the 70s till about the 1990s. And they tended to be either in the horror or the science fiction genre for the most part. And they're not large budget films. He did some work. His movies were released by Roger Corman's New World a lot in the 1980s, and they tend to be quite off the wall, quite idiosyncratic, and they have a kind of anti-establishment and also anti-religion and corporation and government bias to them, which makes them kind of interesting. He does have a clear directorial and authorial viewpoint and agenda, and I found that more interesting than a lot of people who just go with the corporate line and pick up the journeyman jobs and things like that. He produces his own films, he directed them, he wrote most of them, and I found that impressive. He has done some stuff in the noughties as well. He did one episode of Masters of Horror, which I haven't seen yet, but it's on my list to pick up. Anyway, I'll start off. I'll do a little bit of a break now, and then I'll give you a bit of an idea about the life of Larry Cohen, and then I'll go and talk about a number of his films. I won't be hitting every film. I may name check them, but I want to talk in detail about a few of his films. So another little bit of a break, and then I'll get into it.
When an irresistible force such as you meets an old immovable object like me, you can bet as sure as you live. Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give. When an irrepressible smile such as yours warms an old implacable heart such as mine, don't say no because I insist.
Don't resist.
Somewhere, somehow, someone's gonna be kissed. So on guard, who knows what the fates have in store. From their vast, mysterious sky, I'll try hard, ignoring those lips I adore. But how long can anyone try? Fight, 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 fight it with all of our might. Chances are some heavenly, star-spangled night. We'll find out as sure as we live.
As sure, as sure, as sure.
Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give.
When an irresistible force
such as you
meets an old immovable object
like me,
you can bet as sure as you live.
That's for sure. Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give. Such as yours
warms an old implacable heart
such as mine.
Oh no, don't say no because you'll insist.
Oh, you know I will. Somewhere, somehow, someone's gonna be kissed. So on guard, who knows what the fates have in store. From their vast mysterious sky, I'll try hard, ignoring those lips I adore. But how long can anyone try? Fight, 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 fight it with all of our might. Chances are some heavenly star-spangled night. We'll find out as sure as we live.
As sure, as sure, as sure.
Something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give. Somewhere, someplace, sometime, somehow. Could come tomorrow, could even come now. Something oughta, something's gotta give.
That, of course, was Lorne Greene from Bonanza singing Something's Gotta Give. I'm kind of getting into actors singing again at the moment, and I just thought I'd throw that in there as a bit of an energy lift and a weirdness check. And anyway, on to the career of Larry Cohen. He was born in New York on the 15th of July, 1941. He's a producer, director, and writer of films. He started out after graduating in film study at the City College of New York, writing for television shows, and he created two classic TV series in the early 1960s, being Branded and The Invaders. I know Vince over at B Movie Cast is a big fan of The Invaders, so Larry Cohen created that one. He then moved on after a while to doing films. His first film in 1972 was Bone. I'll talk about that in a bit. He went on to make a number of other films, including Black Caesar, Hell Up in Harlem, It's Alive, God Told Me To, which also is known as Demon, Four Men High, Cue the Winged Serpent, The Stuff, Return to Salem's Lot, The Ambulance, Original Gangsters in 1996, and basically all those sorts of genre films. I mean, he started out doing Bone, which, as I said, I'll talk about in a sec, and Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem, which were both blaxploitation films of a sort. And then he kind of moved on to where his real love seems to be, which is horror and science fiction. So one of the other things I should mention about him before we move on to the movies himself is in 2003 he tried to sue 20th Century Fox, claiming that the company had intentionally plagiarized a script of theirs entitled Cast of Characters with his writing producing partner Martin Pohl, this is, in order to create the Sean Connery film League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. The lawsuit went absolutely nowhere and probably cost him a lot of money because, of course, everyone knows that Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill came up with the idea of it independently. in 1999, and the movie For All Its Sins, and it wasn't done very well, was based on the graphic novel by Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill. Anyway, on to the films themselves. I did watch Bone, and you can find that around the place. Don't know whether it's on DVD. I really haven't done my homework on that, and I do apologise. But I did manage to acquire it from the usual suspects. And I found it quite interesting. It's kind of a four-hander in a way. A wealthy couple living in Beverly Hills, the male of whom, played by Andrew Duggan, is swimming in their swimming pool. He's a kind of middle-aged, late middle-aged man, and finds that there's a rat in his swimming pool and it gets sucked into the filter. So he and his wife, played by Joyce Van Patten, decide to call the pool cleaning service and get somebody out there to fix the thing up. While they're on the phone to the pool cleaning service, a black man in working clothes, played by Yaphet Kotto, turns up and offers to take the rat out of the pool filter. Now, the couple don't have any cash on them down near the swimming pool, so they take him up to the house and claim not to have any money for it. And the black man, using the mystique that black men have or had in society at that stage, begins to terrorize them and demand money from them, and generally acting on their white guilt in order to get what he wants. I won't go too much into the synopsis for it, but I'll give you the IMDb one just to give you a little more of an idea of what it's about. The IMDb synopsis isn't quite accurate, but it kind of gives you the gist of the thing. A thief breaks into the home of a wealthy, happily married Beverly Hills couple. He soon finds out, though, that the couple is neither as wealthy as he thought they were and not as happily married as they appear. Now, the film kind of runs with that and takes a look at the way race relations were in the United States at the time. Takes a look at commercialism. The Andrew Duggan character is a used car salesman, and there's a surrealistic kind of nightmare scene at the start of the film where he's doing an ad for his used cars, and it kind of goes off into some weird and wonderful areas that may look like they have been influenced by Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend. But I kind of enjoyed this film. It's good to see those kind of time capsule-y, how things were perceived of about society kind of films at the time. There's the sexual mystique of the black man as played by Yaphet Kotto's character. He tells the Andrew Duggan character to go to the bank and get him money, otherwise he's going to rape the wife. But things don't quite turn out like that. And while at the bank, the Andrew Duggan character, I should really give name check the character here, just give me a few moments. The character is Bill, and his wife's name is Bernadette. Bill meets a girl played by Jeannie Berlin, Elaine May's daughter in real life, and she just is just called the girl, and kind of has a liaison with her while out and about trying to get this money that he's got to find so that the black man won't ransack his house and ostensibly rape his wife.
Now look, Mother. You live in a big house, you make big money, and you got big bread, and now I want you to tell me where it is. Do you hear me? Tell me where it is.
Look, I got $32,000 and two traveler's checks. Now, I want some money. I want some money right now.
Is that clear now?
We don't have anything else.
Oh, he's telling the truth. All we have are credit cards.
See those bills downstairs. But why didn't you listen to me? No, you listen. You ain't got no balance in your account. That means you got cash here in the house.
Or what?
Or you in one hell of a mess. Shit. You got the biggest house here in the neighborhood. Big car agencies all over. That's how I come and pick you out. All you got is bills up to your ass.
Doesn't really turn out like that, but it's a kind of dark comedy on America during the Nixon era. Not incredibly successful as that, but it's amusing and it's idiosyncratic and it's non-mainstream. I'm not sure it's particularly deep, but it feels very much to me like a play. I mean, it could have been done as a four-handed play on stage, and it's got that kind of encapsulated world feel about it, which I found kind of interesting and different for a kind of B movie of that time. It looks like it could have been something more if there was a little more time to develop the script and a little more money to run with making the film. And that's a common thing with a lot of Larry Cohen's films. If there's a little more time and a little more money, they could have been more than they are. And I suppose that's, but for being movie directors, that's always something you've got to balance off when you're making the film. Do I make the film now, or do I wait to see if there's more money? Do I wait to develop it a little more and maybe get a script doctor in and kind of workshop it a little bit, or do I just run with it and take the money? So I think that Coen's that sort of director, in that he really wanted to say something. He had something to say. He wanted to say it. And so he got things out there. And I don't think he's kind of a fantastic director. I think he's an interesting one. I think the stuff he makes is always very watchable. But I'm not really convinced that he's a top-of-the-line director. Nor does he need to be to tell these stories. The stories themselves, within the limitations that he's got, and sometimes there's special effects limitations and budgetary limitations, and sometimes the actors aren't quite where they need to be to carry across what Coen's trying to do. And you know, you get all those things that happen with B-film that kind of make them a little bit handmade and edgy. So that was his first film, and then of course Blaxploitation was very big in the early 70s, and he went on to make Black Caesar with Fred Williamson, which is a remake of Little Caesar starring Edward G. Robinson, and there are a lot of commonalities to it, but instead of being set in the Italian part of New York in the 1920s and 1930s, it's set in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s in Harlem.
A king of crime is born. A mob boss who started in the streets, ready to do anything for a payoff, no matter what it cost. Became an overlord of the underworld with every trick in the book.
You forget, huh? You make fools of your people. You shame them. They kill you. You do this to me after I gave you your chance. Who else am I gonna do it to, huh?
Fred Williamson, in the private war of an angry man, whose hate was spelled out in the blood of his enemies, his violence in the curses of his women.
Now, take a look at Harlem. You tell me, who's going to control these people? It's a jungle, and it takes a jungle bunny to wreck it.
Black Caesar. Every mob organization in town is out to get it.
And the Fred Williamson character, who is has a limp because of an accident caused by a corrupt cop when he was a young guy, decides to take over Harlem from the mafia. And there are some, yeah, as a exploitation film, I don't think it stands out the way something like Shaft or Superfly or Sweetback's Badass Song do. But I think it's a perfectly reasonable little programmer there, enough so to generate a sequel hell up in Harlem. The film has what you pretty much need to have in a good blaxploitation film. You need a bit of nudity in there, you need a lot of violence, and one of the things that comes out in this film that I really like is the start of something that's almost a signature of a Larry Coen film, and it happens in a few of his other films. It happens in God Told Me To, which is also known as Demon. It turns up in Cue the Winged Serpent and a bunch of other films. That is filming on the streets. They film on the streets of New York in this one. And one of the bits that goes on, I think, a little longer than it should, but Fred Williamson's Tommy Gibbs character, the Black Caesar, is shot in the side by some rogue cops who want him off the streets and want him out of the way so that business as usual can continue. And he staggers into a taxi and after being shot on the streets. And I think that from what I can see, it looks like guerrilla filmmaking. They didn't set this up with the people around them. There are a lot of people who think that somebody's really been shot. And so they film it in the streets of New York, not too far away from Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, and continued as he commandeers a taxi with the actors playing the cops chasing him with guns down the middle of a New York street. Now, of course, you couldn't do this any time now because the cops would stop you. They've got all those terrorist alert kind of things. You can't do that kind of guerrilla filmmaking anymore, but it's really interesting to watch it and think that most of the people in the scenes who are in the crowd scenes on this busy middle-of-the-day New York street don't know what the fuck's going on. They can see the cameras probably and they can see the actors, but they're not quite clued into it. And I kind of like that. I like that because it gives the reactions of the crowd are genuine. They're genuinely going, what the fuck? While this action plays out on the streets with a small camera crew, a few actors, and a taxi cab. So in that sense, it's quite good and it's quite uncontrolled. There's a randomness to what's happening there that's created by the fact that they didn't have permission to film there and they just went out there and did it. So Black Sea is an interesting film. Hell Up in Harlem, interesting film as well. If you're into blaxploitation at all, they're definitely worth checking out. Hell Up in Harlem came out in 1973. In 1974, Larry Cohen went in a totally different direction with a film called It's Alive, which is about a baby who was born and who was mutated into basically a cannibalistic killer baby. Which is pretty confronting stuff in 1974. It's around the time of The Exorcist, and people found it very transgressive to have a teenage girl being totally demonic. So Larry Cohen kind of upped the ante a little bit and had basically a baby that came out of the womb with razor-sharp teeth and an incredible will to survive.
It's alive. It's alive.
Can you hear me? It can't be saved. It's gotta die.
It's alive. It's alive.
Why are you so anxious to be the one to do it?
It's alive.
Doctor! Stand aside here!
It's alive.
Now, nobody knows how this thing happened. It's really a matter of speculation, and I think perhaps that's for the best. After all, if we find out that the cause is medication that we manufacture, and it was administered over a long period of time on it...
What do your interests recommend?
Absolute destruction of this thing.
It went down the storm drains.
That's how it can travel the length of the city without anybody seeing it.
Don't touch me. Don't you touch me. They stole my baby. Come on, get down. Did you see it? Did you see it? What does it look like?
What are you afraid of?
Get those cameras out of my face, please. I got no comment. I had nothing to do with this.
Will you get that thing out of my face? Get out of the way!
He could have killed you. You know why he didn't? You know why he didn't kill you?
Look out, Charlie!
You've never been exposed to radioactivity in radioactive material or undergone extensive x-rays.
No, Doctor, I told you.
Can't rule out genetic damage.
My department has already cautioned the police about excessive violence. If it could be dispatched with a bullet, or better still, some kind of a gas. Undoubtedly, it is very small, and any kind of bodily harm, especially from gunshots or explosives.
In other words, you want me to sign away the body, is that it?
Well, it's your right. After all, you are the child's father.
It's Alive is one of those fantastic cult films. I first saw it in the cinema way back when, and I liked it. It stars John P. Ryan, as opposed to John C. Reilly. John P. Ryan, Sharon Farrell, James Dixon, who's a redheaded character actor who appeared in a lot of Cohen's early films. He was in... You've shot Fred Williamson in Black Caesar. He was in Cue the Winged Serpent. He was in It's Alive. He turns up in a lot of them, along with Andrew Duggan, again, from Bone. Guy Stockwell's in it. Michael Anzara. The music's by Bernard Herrmann. And the monster baby was made by Rick Baker, who is probably one of the famous, most famous prosthetic artists in movie history. He did the makeup for Gorillas in the Mist and all sorts of other things. If you look up Rick Baker's filmography, you're going to find some of the best genre films around. And it's a lot of fun. It goes into that thing of, I mean, the basic subtext is the kind of technological lifestyle and the industrial lifestyle that we're living affecting our children? And this, of course, takes it to an extreme end when you get bald cannibal babies. But the movie was successful enough to spawn two sequels. The second one, just get my filmography back here. Sorry about the rattling. The second one was It Lives Again in 1978. The third one was for made for TV called It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive in 1987, where the babies have been put on an island and have grown up. Now, the next film that Cohen did is called God Told Me To. Now, the name was changed by Roger Corman, who ran New World Pictures at the time, to Demon, but it's basically... The premise of it is, well, Larry Cohen went to the National Gallery in London and saw a whole bunch of religious art that was very violent and gory, and it kind of triggered something in the back of his mind where he thought, what if all of our religions were formed by space aliens? Now, the movie starts pretty interestingly with a sniper on top of a water tower in the middle of New York shooting people. And again, Cohen filmed this on the street, so there are people walking down the street and suddenly someone next to them is... blood spurts out of them and they fall to the street. And there's a sniper, and the police detective, played by an Italian-American actor called Tony LoBianco, corners the sniper and tries to talk him down on top of this water tower in the middle of New York and asks him why he did it. And the guy says, God told me to. And there are a bunch of different murders that come up through the film where people believe that they've seen God and God told them to commit barbaric acts. I won't do the spoilers on the story. That's the basic setup of it, but things are not what they seem. And the basic premise, as I said, is that our gods were created by rather vindictive and unknowable space aliens. And it's quite good fun. It's got Tony LoBianco in it. It's got Richard Lynch playing the god demon space alien character. Sylvia Sidney's in, a character actress who was in Sabotage with the Hitchcock film in 1935 when she was a young person. So she's in there as well. She was also in Beetlejuice, amongst other things, in her later career. Fantastic character actress with a terrific face and large eyes. God told me to definitely try to find that one, because it's one of the most cohesive of Cohen's films up to that point. And quite interesting. Now, the next film he made was something called The Private Files of J. Edgar Hoover. I haven't been able to find a copy of this yet. If anybody can steer me in the direction of it, please do, because I'd be interested to see it. It was shown at a retrospective a few years ago in Hollywood, and Cohen had a bit of a talk before the film was shown. It's probably the rarest of his films, of his major films at least. I think it had Broderick Crawford in it playing J. Edgar Hoover. I don't have too many details about that, but it is one I'd definitely like to see. That was in 1977. In 1978, he made It Lives Again, the sequel to It Lives. And in 1981, there's a little bit of a gap there, in 1981... he made Full Moon High, a werewolf comedy which kind of predated Teen Wolf. A guy bitten by a werewolf in the 1950s who doesn't age and suddenly comes back 20 years later, and all of the people he went to high school with have turned into total shits, and the girl he lusted after in high school, his girlfriend, is a 40-year-old, still rather horny and repressed, a desperate housewife kind of character. And yeah, I saw this a few years ago, but haven't seen it recently. And it's kind of very broad comedy and a fairly amusing thing. It was one of those films that came out on Roadshow Video in Australia in the 1980s, and I had a copy of it for a while, but really hasn't stuck in my memory very much. I'm not sure that kind of broad comedy is what Cohen does best, but nonetheless, it's there. He also made a movie called See China and Die in 1981. Again, I don't know too much about that one. But in 1982, he came back again with one of his kind of best films in, from my point of view, which is known as Q, but it's also known as Q the Winged Serpent. I'll give you a little bit of a trailer on that, and then I'll talk about it because it's one of the most fun Larry Cohen movies.
For 10 centuries, it has waited to be awakened, to be worshipped again like a god, to fill the skies, to cast its shadow over the earth, to release its fury. Today in New York City, the winged serpent rises. The winged serpent rules. The winged serpent. David Carradine.
This thing has been prayed back into existence.
Michael Moriarty.
It was big and there was something in it that looked like an egg. But it couldn't have been an egg. I mean, there aren't any eggs. There's no egg that big.
Richard Roundtree.
What I want to know is, how the hell is this tie in with the murders and the mutilations?
Candy Clark.
What are you going to do if someone dies tomorrow or the next day or the next day?
Well, I'm not going to think about it. You know, it won't be my fault. It'll be theirs if they don't give me what I want.
Money. $1 million in cash, tax-free.
They are searching.
Looking good.
Discovering. Believing. Preparing for the battle of a thousand years.
Load tracer ammunition. Want to see the trajectory.
Get those guys out of the basket.
Okay, everybody hold their positions. Everybody stay right where you are, all right? Don't move.
Man against the fantastic flying forces of a lost age.
You like saying a prayer?
The winged serpent. Today in New York City, the winged serpent rules. The legend has come alive.
Q the Winged Serpent is a lot of fun, and it's not just the stop motion flying lizard. It's basically down to Michael Moriarty playing Jimmy Quinn. Quinn is the protagonist of the film, and he's a petty crim who, after an unsuccessful robbery, hides in the top of the Chrysler Building, where he finds a giant nest with a giant egg in it. And meanwhile, people are dying in New York, being torn off buildings by some kind of monster. And Jimmy, having discovered this, suddenly realizes that he's got a chance at being quite successful and having a lot of money by selling the information on where this creature's nest is to the cops. The film's got a pretty good cast. It's got David Carradine in it, playing one of the cops, Richard Roundtree playing another one. Candy Clark's good in it, but Michael Moriarty as Jimmy is fantastic. It's a better piece of acting than you expect to see in a film like this. And he's the center of it. And there's a lot of improvisation that went on when Cohen and Moriarty were making Q, where they set up a scene and just get him to improvise on it. In fact, the first scene with David Carradine in it as well was totally improvised, because Larry Cohen met Carradine in Cannes at the Cannes Film Festival and said, come down here with a suit, I'm going to give you a couple of lines to say, and then we'll talk about the rest of the film. So Carradine in the bar where he first meets Jimmy Quinn, when Jimmy's singing a song about an evil dream and basically auditioning for a job as a piano player in this bar, was totally improvised, and Carradine had no idea what his character was, what his character was doing or anything. Cohen then that night gave him the script, and Carradine understood what his character was, and he really liked the role, because it was one of the few times in the career of David Carradine where he got to play funny. He got to make jokes, he got to wisecrack a little bit. His character's a little bit lighter than the usual stoic kinds of people that Carradine was asked to play in film. And the centre of it still is very much Michael Moriarty as Jimmy Quinn. He's a punk, he's scared, he's an ex-junkie, he's trying to get his life together, but events seem to be conspiring against him getting that together, even if he does have the support of his girlfriend. And Candy Clark seemed to specialize in girlfriend roles. I mean, she was David Bowie's girlfriend in The Man Who Fell to Earth, for instance. But she's kind of got a bit of heart in this. I saw her in a film recently. What was it? The Informant. I think Candy Clark was in The Informant, the Steven Soderbergh film that came out earlier this year. Yeah, she played the Matt Damon character's mother in The Informant. So nice to see her in film again, which is kind of cool. But Cue the Winged Serpent is one of those popcorn movies. It really kind of, it's the kind of film that did well because VHS and Betamax were coming out at the time, and people could rent copies of a film and just sit down on a Saturday night, make their own popcorn and just have a bit of fun watching a film. And it does very much hark back to 1950s monster movies as well. It's got a very kind of theremin-y movie score. It's you know, there's a mystery there, and rather than it being out in the Arizona desert the way a lot of these giant monster films in the 50s were, or in remote locations, it's set in the biggest and most active city in the world. Now, when they were making the film, there were some great scenes on the Chrysler Building, and they filmed in and on the Chrysler Building. They were doing renovations on the building at the time, so Cohen and his crew kind of almost snuck up there, hired a bunch of steeplejacks to put on cop uniforms and fire machine guns from these little cradles that were mounted at the side of the Chrysler Building while the renovations were going on, and while the helicopter was swooping around, basically pretend to be shooting at a giant monster. Now, they got in a lot of trouble for this because people could hear the shots down on the street. And so while they crazily got all these steeplejacks, and they couldn't even get stuntmen to do this because none of them wanted to be standing on a little cradle on the side of the Chrysler Building. So they had to hire steeplejacks. Because everyone downstairs could hear the gunfire, they got in a lot of trouble with the New York Film Commission, and the people running the Film Commission basically said to them, if you can finish your film in New York, that's fine, but no more of these kind of gun scenes or no more action scenes in the street. You know, you're banned from doing that. Now, a lot of the reaction shots that they used of people in the street reacting to basically a gunfight with a giant monster up above were taken from God Told Me To, because they weren't allowed to film any more street scenes in New York after they did their big climactic battle. I do like the helicopter shots in this film as well. They were pretty well done. There's a lot of, they kind of, with using zoom and zoom lenses, basically, they faked the idea of points of view shots for the winged serpent. And there are some great bits where you see an animated shadow of the monster traveling across buildings and things like that. So they did make the effort to put across the idea of this giant flying lizard terrorizing a major metropolis. And it is a great piece of fun. I also like the fact that this film was made in that junction between when New York was getting cleaned up. It's kind of between the really sleazy and dangerous New York of the 1970s and the cleaned up New York of the 1990s. I remember I was in New York in 98. I'd love to go back, but I haven't had the opportunity since. But it took me a fair while to find a sleazy porno place, arcade kind of place, anywhere near Times Square in New York. It was all Disney and cinemas and microbrew breweries and all sorts of places like that. So I had to go a few blocks away from Times Square to find that kind of last remnant of 1970s New York sleaze. So, yeah, Cue the Winged Serpent, fantastic film. The next one of his films, that of Cohen's films that I want to talk about, is the last one of the ones that I found really interesting. There are a couple of other things he's done since which are okay. But his 1985 film, The Stuff, is a lot of fun too. Again, it stars Michael Moriarty, and I'll just play a little bit of audio from it and then talk about The Stuff. It's the premise of the film is basically, what if the blob from the Steve McQueen movie was delicious?
Look, are you sure we want to get mixed up with industrial spies?
Hey, look, I want results, and he's the best there is. And it's men like Mo Rutherford that help us stay in business.
Yes, I suppose we do have to keep the world safe for ice cream.
Oh, this is some place you got here, fellas. Mm. This is gosh, Lemmy, that's a sweaty palm. That's two sweaty palms. Lemmy, for you. Ah, that's another sweaty palm. Yes, sir. Hello, sweaty palms.
How do you do?
So tell me about the stuff.
Now, look, you've been briefed on this problem.
Well, not completely. I don't understand why you didn't go to the Food and Drug Administration.
Well, for one reason or another, right after it was approved, most of those involved resigned. They're either out of the country or on vacation.
Or they had been paid off. That is the American way, you know.
We've never had so much trouble getting information out of a company.
Oh, don't you worry about that. Every stone wall has a chink in it. I'll get inside there. I'll penetrate the company. I'll do some damage.
The stuff's basically Larry Cohen's polemic against consumerism. It involves a sticky white substance that a man walking through a mine discovers. The man eats the substance rather than sticking it with a stick, and he finds out that it's delicious. And so he and his friend find out that it's kind of addictive and things like that. And later on, the stuff is marketed as the stuff, and it's a kind of dessert food that's replacing ice cream. It's low in fat. It's got very few calories to it, but it's addictively delicious. So a former FBI agent turned industrial saboteur, David Mo Rutherford, played by Michael Moriarty again, is hired by the leaders of the ice cream industry, as well as a junk food mogul, to basically find out what the stuff is and to stop it. Along the way, he meets Andrea Markovici, her character's a marketing person who markets the stuff, and chocolate chip Charlie Hobbs, played by Garrett Morris, who's a chocolate chip cookie manufacturer who's put out of business by the people who run the stuff and isn't trying to investigate what's actually happening with it. Now, it turns out the stuff's actually a living parasitic organism which takes over the human brain and replicates itself inside the human beings. A little boy called Jason, played by Scott Bloom, discovers that the stuff is alive, and he meets up with Mo Rutherford and these people, and basically they set out to stop the stuff, find out what it is, where it's coming from, and to stop it. In the meantime, they sign up with a right-wing nutcase called Colonel Malcolm Grummet Spears, played by Paul Sorvino, who runs a kind of right-wing militia that Mo Rutherford once investigated. And they involve Colonel Spears in fighting and outlying and telling people about the stuff, because he runs a right-wing radio station. He's kind of like a miniature Fox News kind of thing. And, yeah, this is played very broadly. The acting in it's pretty good. I don't think Moriarty's as good in this as he was in Cue the Winged Serpent, but he's still pretty interesting and quirky and a bit of a nutcase. He was kind of like the guy who played Christopher Walken characters before Christopher Walken did, if you know what I mean. In this one, he's wearing quite a bad rug, but it kind of works in favour of the character in a weird kind of way. Danny Aiello's in it in a minor role. Patrick O'Neill, character actor from years ago, in there. And basically they set out to stop the stuff. And again, this film's a lot of fun. They have people eating tons and tons of this white yogurty stuff. The thing, what they actually used in the movie for it was Häagen-Dazs ice cream, yogurt, and for one scene involving a large amount of it, they use fire extinguisher foam. So, and there are some special effects bits that are quite interesting. They use the rotating room that was used from the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie during one scene where the stuff comes out of a mattress and pillows to attack Mo Rutherford and his people and his girlfriend, the Andrea Markovici character. Why am I not saying what the names of characters are if they're female today? I'm really having a bad day for that, so I apologise to any female listeners. It's not intended. But, the stuff is a lot of fun. Sal enjoyed it too. She said that watching it made her hungry for ice cream. So, obviously, not only is the stuff addictive, but watching it in the movie is addictive. And we had to go out for ice creams last night just to satisfy that particular hunger. Now, again, this is a New Worlds picture. It was released by Roger Corman's company. And, again, it's one of those films that did really well on on video at the time, because it's the kind of thing people want to rent on Saturday night. It kind of hit that right note for being like a satirical horror comedy, science fiction-y kind of thing, film. And And yeah, I enjoyed it a lot rewatching. I've seen it about 3 times now, and each time I kind of pick up little bits that I didn't pick up before. And again, it's worth watching. Now, Larry Cohen's done a number of other things since. He did an episode of Masters of Horror, as I said. He did a movie called The Ambulance in 1990, starring Eric Roberts, which is a bit of fun. Again, it's set in New York City. He's also written scripts for a number of other films as well, which he didn't direct. He did the Armand Asante Eye of the Jury film in the 1980s, I think it was. Let me just see what else I've got there. He did Phone Booth, the 2002 movie starring Colin Farrell. He did Cellular 2004. He wrote the screenplay for Captivity in 2007. So he's been writing things. Maniac Cop, he did this again. He's written much more for as a scriptwriter than he ever did as a filmmaker in the directorial sense. He wrote the script for Bestseller, the Brian Dennehy James Woods movie in 1987. So Larry Cohen, interesting cult filmmaker. He really does deserve to be recognised as that.
Hi, it's Narelle M. Harris, author of The Opposite of Life, a vampire novel set in Melbourne. If anyone out there would like to make it into a film, call me. You listen to Paleo Cinema Podcast. Bye.
Okay, the voicemail line's working really well for me, so I really appreciate people who are leaving voicemails for me. Now, I've got one that I missed last time around, and I do apologise to Rupert. It slipped through the cracks, and I didn't get to play it on the podcast. So I'm going to do that right now, and then I'll put on his second piece of feedback, and then we'll move on with the rest of them.
Hey, Terry, this is Rupert. Listening to the 50th episode. Congrats on 50 episodes. Great show. Keep it up, please. Dug the show. Added The Wild Party to the top of my Netflix queue. I don't know that I'd ever heard of that film. Somehow I'd missed that one. And God of Gamblers I need to see too, obviously. Great stuff. I love the Fuller Show too. I have to agree with Ben from Cinecultania. I'm also a big fan of Baron of Arizona. I love Vincent Price in that. I love him in a movie called His Kind of Woman also. Anyway, there's a couple 70s movies I don't think you've covered. Maybe you've talked about them. One is, both actually coincidentally star Art Carney. One is The Late Show, the Robert Benton film, which I think is totally underseen and underrated. You know what? I'll bet you've talked about that one. And then the other one is Going in Style, with him and George Burns, and I forget the other guy. Just a really touching, one of my favorites, that film. Wondered if you might ever cover those, if they're outside the realm of paleo cinema. But anyway, keep up the great work. Love the show. I'll be MP3-ing again soon. Okay, bye.
Thanks for that, Rupert. I saw The Late Show ages ago, but I haven't seen the other one you mentioned. I'll see what I can track down on those two. It sounds like they're definitely part of what I'm doing here, so I'm going to have to re-watch them and kind of evaluate. So thanks for the tips. Do appreciate it when people give me tips on things to cover. I don't always cover them, but at least they steer me in the right direction. And I do know for a fact that the Sam Fuller episode was one of the most downloaded ones that I've done. So I've really got to play to that a little bit and maybe hit some more Fuller later and those type of things as well. By the way, while I'm speaking about Sam Fuller, Larry Cohen in the 1990s lived in Sam Fuller's old house in Coldwater Canyon in Hollywood. Here's Rupert's second voicemail. So thank you for both of them, Rupert. I do appreciate the feedback, mate.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Trying out your new voicemail line. Listen to the new show. Love the recommends of Went the Day Well and The Tunnel. I hadn't heard of either of those. I'm going to totally check those out. I love that you're covering some Mamet. I'm not a huge fan of House of Games for the reason I know you expressed that you had a problem with Lindsay Krause's performance the first time, and then upon subsequent viewings, it made sense. Unfortunately, I've seen it a few times, and I can't get around that performance. That's stilted. I understand it's motivated by the character and the plot of the movie and everything, but it just drives me nuts. It's like nails on a chalkboard. I just can't. It just feels like sour notes being played. I can't listen to it and not think this is just bad acting. And even as good as Montaigne is, and he's great, when the two of them are in a scene together, it just kind of throws me off because I don't believe his character would buy her character, and I know that can be part of the plot a little bit, but just cannot get around it. So I've never bought that one, but I do like his other films. I think he's a great writer, and I think he's definitely worth checking out. So great show. I will be calling again. Okay, bye.
Thanks for that, Rupert. I've really been thinking about the Lindsay Krauss thing since I heard your voicemail, and I don't know whether I'm kind of doubting my judgment on this one again. Maybe I wanted her acting to be better than it was, and I was kind of projecting on that. Okay, moving on. We've now got a voicemail from Big William from Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema.
Hey, Terry. It's Will from The Gentleman's Guide. Just figuring I'd call, since I had access to call you, as opposed to trying to coordinate something with my co-host, because it seems when the two of us get together, we become exponentially more absent-minded. So I wanted to take this opportunity to congratulate you on 50 episodes, 50-plus, for that matter, and just let you know that, again, I really, really appreciate what you do. I think you do a fantastic job. And keep up the great, great work, as I've said a million times about your show and any of the excellent one-man shows that are out there. It's a difficult, thankless job, and you do it with ease and class, and don't change a thing. I mean, I love the musical interludes. I think it's all just fantastic. I did have a question for you. Since older films certainly are more up your alley, noir is a genre that I'm familiar with, and I've seen some noir films. I'm aware of it, but I want to know if you could recommend me, I don't know, maybe a handful of essential noir films to get me on the right track, to kind of get the ball rolling. So I look forward to hearing your response. Keep up the great work, and hopefully me and Rick will get together soon and shoot you something over together. All right, man. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for that, Will. I appreciate it coming from you guys, because you, in some senses, I find you guys the benchmark I'm working against, even though you guys do a tandem job. That kind of level of quality is something that I aspire to. I don't know whether I hit it or not. It's for other people to judge, but I've definitely got a lot of respect for what you and Sam do. So, well, Sam, Rick, whatever. Anyway, film noir recommendations. Leave It to Heaven with Gene Tierney, I like a lot. Laura, you got to hit Laura if you haven't hit Laura already. Angel Face, I did that on an early podcast with Robert Mitchum and Gene Simmons in it. The Big Combo, definitely, with Richard Conte and Cornel Wilde. Did that in another podcast as well. Just anything that's got the tag, give it a go. And of course, you've got to do Detour. The it's in public domain, that one, the one with Tom Neal in it. And if you can go back to Scorsese's documentary on American cinema, 100 Years of American Cinema, I forget what the other one's called. But anyway, that kind of stuff. Hopefully those ones will get you started. There's also another Gene Tierney one called Whirlpool, which is rather interesting. So give them a go to start with. Oh, yeah, Ida Lupino in Private Hill 36. I could go on forever, but I won't. So that should get you started. If you need more recommendations, give me a call or drop me an email. I'm more than happy to kind of give you a definitive list on that and, of course, to anybody else as well. Now I got a voicemail from our friend Vince over at the B-Movie Cast. The Lucky Bastard just interviewed John Saxon, so definitely download that episode of his cast. And again, any podcasts out there about movies, give them all a go. Everybody's going to have a different taste, but there are some people out there doing some excellent work, and I'm finding it an incredibly fruitful thing to listen to on my morning walks, which I walk from where Sally works to where I work, which is basically going across Melbourne City. And I am catching up on my podcast, and I really should offer some feedback to some of them soon once I get over the fact that I've just finished about 2 months of training and my brain is gone fluffy. But here we go. Here's Vince.
Hey, Terry. This is Vince. Just calling in, trying out your new toll-free number, your new voicemail number. I'm on the way home from work, so I thought I'd try it out. Just listened to the last show, episode 51, I believe it was. Really good show. Yeah, Mamet, he's one of my favorite screenwriters or playwrights or whatever you want to call them. Him and Tennessee Williams, I guess, are my two favorites. My The only really movie I think I've seen of his is Glengarry Glen Ross. That's definitely on my top 100 all-time movies, I think. And you mentioned Spartan with Val Kilmer. I have that movie laying up there in my collection. I must have had it laying there for a couple of years. You just reminded me I might have to dust that one off and go watch it. Anyway, like I said, just trying out the new phone line. I'll probably be calling in again and keep the shows coming.
Thanks for that, Vince. I'm not sure whether I'm going to cover any Tennessee Williams in future, but it's definitely something to think about. Yeah, Mamet's films are great. The Spanish Prisoner's great. I like Red Belt, the one he did with Chiwetel Ejiofor. Any of those ones is a fantastic film to watch. And that's about all I've got to say on that. I did get an email or two. I'll just drag those up and we'll get that and then I'll finish off. I did get an email from Corey in Seattle, which is one of my favourite cities in the US. It says, "Hello, Terry. I was turned on to your podcast by Troy Date and have been enjoying it for the last 6 months or so. Working through your back catalogue has been really fun. I wanted to congratulate you on the 50th episode. I also wanted to tell you my podcast, So What Are You Watching? We just recorded our third episode, but the second one featured a review of David Mamet's Homicide. I'm not always one for promotion, but seeing that your next episode has House of Games, I thought you'd be interested. I really like that one of the main themes of your cast is the supportive web of genre fans from all continents coming together to enjoy this stuff as a loose community. It's quite positive and fun, which, as most film geeks are a bit curmudgeonly, I find super refreshing. So thanks for the great listening, Corey in Seattle." Thanks for that, Corey. Yeah, that's what it's about. I don't think that I think that knowledge and enthusiasm should be shared. I don't think it's it should be held to your chest as secret knowledge and as a way of empowering trivia buffs. I really think that that communication is fun. Every time me and my mate Jamie get together, we talk about film and we just have a great time doing that. And that love of cinema is what the podcast is about. So that's about it for this time around. Drop a voicemail if you like. Drop an email if you like. Leave a comment at the website. Doesn't matter which. Always glad to hear from people. So enjoy your movie viewing and I will be back in 3 weeks with something brand new.